This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashrin Johan. We're just about 3 weeks away from the Johor State elections. Now, many experts have stressed the importance of the upcoming elections, not just to Johorians, but with regard to our national political landscape as well. The 2018 general elections, the historic general elections, highlighted the need for a united opposition in the battle against Barisan Nasional. However, it has become painfully clear, if it wasn't already, that the opposition today is far from united. As they say, how now, brown cow? Joining me on the show to help me unpack it all is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. Welcome to the show, Bridget.
Always great to be here.
Let's get some overall thoughts first, Bridget. The opposition always talks about being a united force to take on Barisan Nasional. We've heard this rhetoric many times. We're now mere weeks away from the upcoming Johor elections. Are they actually proving to be a united force?
Well, using your analogy of the cow, let's get to the meat, right? All right. Well, we have a situation where, you know, I think if we step back, the opposition itself is transforming. And I think we need to look at the different kind of drivers that are happening in the opposition. First of all, we see new entrants. Muda is part of that. Warisan is now taking on national roles. And this, you know, leads to competition, challenges over leadership, and also the different platforms and different issues of legitimacy that are slowly starting to emerge. The other thing to keep in mind is that the opposition is not just Pakatan Harapan. It's in some states, it's UMNO, and in other places, it's Bersatu. And what we see is that the opposition is a large field. So when we think about opposition, most people think about it as Pakatan Harapan, they think about it in the rubric of GE14, but in fact, it's actually a transformed rubric and very complex. And so for voters, especially first-time voters, they are able to see, they have more choices, and they have different types of platforms. And you have an oppositions on the right as well as on the left in terms of issues of reform. And of course, the problem with all of this is that the parties themselves, don't have clear policy platforms. They're still very highly personalized vehicles. And then the third thing that's shifting is that we see leadership challenges. Older leaders are really, you know, going to have a very interesting dynamic happening in Johor. Mahathir is his Pejuang's party, he has performed very poorly so far on his own, and he's going to have a test in Johor, as is PKR with Anwar. And, you know, many Malaysians are looking to the future, and these leaders are seen to be tied to the past. And it'll be interesting to see how much they're able to galvanize, given especially in a place like Johor, where almost 18% of the electorate is older voters. And then I think the other big issue in looking at the big picture for the opposition is what the opposition stands for. You know, right now with the memorandum of understanding, for many people, there isn't really a viable opposition to the current government from a perspective of policy platforms and others and in discussions in parliament. So there is the opposition groups, as they're transforming, don't have a clear agenda. And of course, they also have to deal with the fact that their legacy in government also helps them to kind of have forced to have a rethink. And so with this it's a transformative period for the opposition. It's not just about conflicts among themselves. It's about what they stand for and how they're going to transform the political system for the country moving forward.
Now, Bridget, when we talk about an opposition that is far from being united, they're still figuring things out. They are, you know, still recovering from Lanka Sheraton and all of these things. Things are malleable and all of that. When we zoom in at the heart of the recent intense battle has been PKR and Muda. Now, PKR and Muda have been at each other's throats publicly. A lot of the brick throwing and hurling and name calling have been going on publicly on Twitter. And this has been especially heated up since seat negotiations commenced perhaps about a week or so ago, or maybe slightly longer than that. where does this animosity between PKR and Muda stem from? Because as many pointed out, Bridget, sometimes it does seem that PKR is trying to destroy Muda more than the so quote-unquote opposing force or enemy that they are trying to face off against, which is Barisan Nasional. How do you process all of this?
Well, I think first to your original comment about their healing from Sheraton, I think it's useful to look at how UMNO was able to heal very fast and readjust. I think they this is something that Pakatan Harapan has not been able to do. But on the issue of animosity between PKR and Muda, it is no question. We see massive personal attacks, negativity, and in fact, you know, it would almost seem like the cyber troopers and the supporters of the parties are seeing themselves, the others, as the enemy, right, as opposed to, you know, and it's this. Now, where does it come from? I think, first of all, it comes from one, insecurity, the fear from on the part of PKR. There's a fear of displacement. This is a new multi-ethnic party. It challenges PKR's legitimacy at its core. And I think this is at a time when it's not really being able to redefine itself, and it's still dealing with its issues of leadership challenges. The second, of course, is that it is a competition for the most competitive seats. And this is, you know, we always see rancor. And keep in mind, the style of the opposition is to present their differences in public, while BN traditionally has been able to keep those within the tent. I think that, you know, one has to recognize and put some of the rancor to a side, recognizing that that is normal and the style that the opposition works, although it has been tremendously toxic and very negative. I think the third factor is that there, you know, for some supporters, that they see this as a kind of continuation of the Mahathir versus Anwar fight, PKR versus Muda. And, you know, this is problematic because it doesn't, I think, reflect the reality on the ground, number one. And number two, I think it also sees that there is a kind of healing that is needed on the part of PKR, where there's many supporters see the enemies, right? You know, they see enemies everywhere. And PKR is not the only party that has that. I think DP and others also have these type of things of a kind of, you know, under attack and it goes on attack type of response. And this is challenging because opposition parties have been attacked in many cases over time and it's left scars. But I think it is pretty clear that opposition parties have lost track who are their friends and who are their enemies. And they see enemies more places than you might. And importantly, that, you know, in all of this business of fighting, the electorate is missing, and the needs of the electorate and issues of their programs are also more missing. And it does, you know, this type of fighting really only feeds what is a very important transformative dimension of what's happening in politics in Malaysia now, which is anger towards all politicians, sense of kind of, you know, a sense that they're engaged on their own personal interests or kind of, as opposed to sort of going and working on the part of the electorate. And that infighting reinforces these perceptions.
Right. Now, you know, when you brought up something earlier, which is leadership, and I'm wondering, Bridget, you know, whether it's PKR grassroots, you know, constantly perhaps hurling bricks at Muda, is this united opposition that we see, does this highlight a severe lack of leadership in either PKR's camp or Pakatan Harapan's camp or just the opposition bench as a whole? In a lot of times when you look at these sorts of situations, grassroots may have problems and this and that, and they may hurl bricks at each other. But if there is a leader and the leader says, hey, you know, we are fighting a bigger battle, we have bigger goals, we have bigger fish to fry, everybody get in line, it tends to happen. But right now, there isn't that, you know, going on. I'm wondering if it is because of a lack of leadership.
Well, I think there's a crisis of confidence among many people, both within the electorate and within the Pakatan Harapan parties, over the current leadership. And the leadership is, you know, it's difficult to, you know, it sends a message, for example, when you don't want to opt for the coalition's logo and you go it alone. Right. Right? You know, I mean, you're walking out the door from the perspective of the coalition. So I think that that, you know, there is a sense of crisis of confidence within. And of course, this extends to how the perception is within the electorate itself. But within PKR, and this is where we see a big difference, right, that they see an opposite trajectory where they had a party that was extremely divided and split. And now they've come together and they see that they're all unified. And so they see this as that they're more committed to Anwar's leadership, so much so that it's become a very personalized party in this context. It's always been a personal party, but it's become, you know, highly, you know, the sense you must be loyal to Anwar, right, in that context. So I think that this crisis of confidence and leadership is real. But I would say that it's not only for Pakatan Harapan. I mean, the same thing could be said for BN. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who are the leaders? And if we go even extend from Ismail Sabri, I mean, his popularity and the confidence that the public has with him is actually, I think, quite low compared to previous prime ministers. And I think that the issue in terms of UMNO's leadership is even more challenging. So I think these are problems that extend across the political spectrum.
Right. Now, let's switch gears and zoom in a little bit more on MUDA. What is your read exactly on MUDA? Recently, you tweeted out something along the lines of, you know, how MUDA have launched under immense scrutiny. And I think that is absolutely on point there. And on the same note, they have proven to also be able to do, you know, fantastic groundwork. We've seen them mobilize for the floods and all of those things. Even in Syed Saddiq's parliament of Moa, how he raises funds for, you know, and buys some tablets and laptops and all that for his constituents and all of that. But, you know, in recent weeks, they have faced massive criticisms over like involvement of property developer Diane Lee. They have rogue FB Facebook posts which have landed them in hot soup. How strong of a force is Parti MUDA actually shaping up to be ahead of the Johor state elections?
First of all, I want to pick up on something you said earlier about this is a different time. I think, you know, one way to look at what's happening in Malaysia is to recognize that we have a much more sophisticated, engaged electorate that are pushing the envelope. And this is not just true of MUDA, but even of BN and others. Parties are being pushed to the feet to the fire. And so when a new party comes in at a time like now, they're going to have much more scrutiny, much more criticism, right, much more intensity in the way that they engage. But I think MUDA, and to a certain degree, is facing, I think, disproportionately higher level of scrutiny. Because for MUDA, it means different things for different people. For a disengaged Pakatan Harapan core, MUDA represents hope. Like, okay, this one's not working, let's go with this one, right? Mm-hmm. For more sort of disengaged PH core, you know, the people who are fear that they're going to be displaced, that are the kind of then MUDA represents a threat, as we were just discussing. Right. And, you know, for young people, it represents a kind of our chance, you know, our different type of voices. And so we see a kind of pedestal that the party has been put on with high expectations, especially among young people, but also high expectations among those that they want the system to move forward. And at the same time, those that are critical say, you know, that they lack experience and so forth. And so it's going to be the burden that MUDA faces is to offer different sets of policy messages and programs. I think you've mentioned that they're doing some of their politicking and their political engagement differently. What's important about MUDA compared to other parties, at least it seems to be engaging the electorate, which doesn't seem to be the case for many of the others, although I think UMNO is beginning that as it prepares for elections. And I think MUDA faces a challenge to get itself out of the shadow of the past of Pakatan Harapan, but at the same time not to galvanize and get the supporters of Pakatan Harapan. This is not an easy thing to do. You asked about their strength. I think so far we can see three things that I think are important.
Right.
They created an excitement to the campaign compared to Malacca. Number two, I think that they offer a kind of different elements of inclusion by prioritizing the young. All right. And I think the third thing is that they, their agenda is, in terms of their identity, is a little bit different. You know, Pakatan Harapan, for all of its, you know, wanting to bring Malaysia together, became very much hung up on racialized politics. You know, we don't capture the Malays, we represent this group and others. And they were of a generation, the NEP generation in particular, that sees politics in these racialized lenses. I think MUDA does this less so comparatively, and their message of unity is a different type. It's not hung up on the racialized politics to the same degree. And the question will be whether or not they can capture the kind of voters who are fed up with the past, who want to kind of want change, want to move on. And I think this is a real challenge for the party to reach that sense of not alienating traditional opposition voters, but at the same juncture, capturing new base. And I think it's too early to see how well they will be able to do that or how well they wouldn't be able to do that. But we will see how this plays out. I think that if there's one macro trend that we've seen in elections, the behavior in the last three sets of elections, state elections, Sabah, Malacca, and Sarawak, is that new parties who offer kind of different future capture younger voters and considerable share of younger voters. And so I think MUDA is going to be testing and seeing whether or not they can continue that trend.
Bridget, can MUDA still be considered, or perhaps they haven't reached that point yet, a third force like they aspired to be? And I'm asking this because, when they launched, and even until now, they talk about how they want to, rock the political landscape. But right now, they're not exactly competing against both Barisan Nasional and Harapan the same way, let's say, Parti Socialist Malaysia does, for example. Can we blame some of the public for calling them another Harapan component party or Harapan's perhaps youth wing?
So I think PSM doesn't really have traction as a party. We've seen it in the results, but the issues that they represent do, all right, on the left, and issues of inequality and others. And so they have that salience. I would not say that PSM as a political force, as a party in terms of winning seats, is all that effective, but I think in terms of the agenda. Now, I think what is interesting to look at MUDA is to see what it does in terms of its agenda program and how distinct and different this is and how it carves out its own identity. I think that they have, they are trying to find a balance between the political realities and the way that the seats are configured, where you have to win the most vote, right? With the reality of being able to shift and change a system in a country where, ironically, people don't want as much change as people think they do. They want change and reform, but they're also not willing to sacrifice the changes that are involved in those reforms, be it, for example, minimum wage, or be it in issues associated with changing the kind of economic model, or even changing the electoral system, or changing patronage. These are things that, there is still, there are a lot of conservative forces in this country. And so I think it is a delicate balance. I think that the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4 are to me irrelevant. What is important is to look at is how their program and how what they stand for, how they govern themselves, begin to sort of redefine what are the different ways of engaging in politics. Right. And in this regard, I think that by their engagement with their electorate, particularly in the area of the floods and others, I think serves them in good stead. But the fact is that there are also, their programs and what they stand for have not necessarily been clearly defined yet. And I think that's something that's probably going to evolve.
On the show with me today is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. After the break, we discuss some of the other opposition parties, such as Warisan and Perjuang. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. And we're talking about a disunited opposition bloc ahead of the upcoming Johor State elections. So, Bridget, switching to some of the other parties that may throw their names in the hat as well, Warisan is one. It seems like, you know, they are serious. Warisan is serious about competing in Johor. But the problem is, this seems to be independent of their preset alliance with MUDA, because MUDA didn't enter into negotiations with Pakatan Harapan, such as Mat Sabu and Anwar Ibrahim, Lim Guan Eng, and all these people with Shafi Abdal. You know, they were just, MUDA was just doing its own negotiation. So where does Warisan fit into the picture? I'm a little bit confused here.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of confusion for everyone in the way that the process is moving, including myself. But I would say that, you know, Warisan clearly has national ambitions, right? You know, they've stated they want to contest, and I think it's useful to unpack this. I mean, I think Shafi Abdal sees himself as an alternative leader. And I think, you know, that is something that is, I think, quite clear. We also see that they're testing their kind of their message. And I think one of the strengths of Warisan is that it has this kind of non-racialized religious message of basically saying, you know, that message of where, you know, we're focusing on, we would like to focus on not on these race and religion, but on the country first. And in a sense, this is similar to MUDA, where it's in a sense moving past racialized politics, by acknowledging and putting an alternative narrative out there. And I think that they see Johor as a place where that might have traction, given that Johor has many multi-ethnic seats in this regard, and it is a multi-ethnic place. Although one has to also remember that Johor is also the place where UMNO was founded, and there are other dimensions within the context of Johor politics. I think that they're going to, you know, face a very difficult battle, and then for me, that battle in Johor really comes from a kind of lessons of Sabah, right? You know, Sabah wanted its own party, and I think Johorians may see Warisan as outsider, and there is a strong kind of Bangsa Johor and identity from Johor, and I of course it'll depend on who they contest, but I see, you know, they are coming into the mix. And I also think there is still a kind of residual tension between Warisan and PKR, and this is another feature of the Johor elections, is that there are a lot of legacy, personalized antagonisms that are coming into this election. So, for example, between Perjuang and Bersatu, between Warisan and PKR, because I think there's a perception here that Anwar's involvement in Sabah undermined Warisan's success in trying to win the Sabah state elections in 2020. So these things are also going on. And I think Warisan is looking to Johor as a test for its positions, because they all want to be at a position for negotiations for GE15, where they have say, look, we have won these seats, because they know that GE15 for the opposition will be a different type of election. And I think this is, you know, everyone talks about Johor being an election for UMNO. And of course, it's going to matter, but it's also going to matter for what happens to the whole slew of parties, and Warisan wants to be in the mix.
On a similar note, what about Perjuang? Where does Perjuang fit into the picture? Because they have repeatedly, you know, said they are going to contest 42 seats, and they're going to contest all the seats, some seats here and there, and then but still undecided. You know, every time someone interviews someone from Perjuang, they throw a number or they claim that they're going to compete. But how do they fit into this picture, which is already becoming very saturated?
know, saturated is not necessarily a bad thing. People get choice, right? But at the same time, it is a bad thing in terms of this electoral system, because it makes the system, it pulls away votes. It doesn't allow it reduces the chances, and it advantages those who have the incumbent, and right. particularly the incumbent advantage at the state level. So Pedraga said it may win as many as 42 seats. I think they're in negotiations with different parties. I think Pedraga's different than others in that we see that they are in a threefold battle. They're in a battle with PH to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Of course, Mahathir and Anwar in particular, they're in a battle with UMNO because, Pedraga wants to battle against UMNO and against Najib in particular. And then they're in a battle now with Bersatu because Bersatu is seen to betray them. It's no wonder that we see different seats in others because they're really focused on this threefold battle. I think the last one, interestingly, is particularly bitter. It's what I was talking about, these personal antagonisms. But I think what Pedraga is a bigger test for is what role Mahathir plays in politics. Anwar, may face a challenge of his leadership in Pakatan Harapan. Of course, he may still be the leader for Pakatan Harapan after the election, but of course, it's whether or not he gets damaged or not in Johor. He's already been damaged from two elections. But for Mahathir, this is his last stand, in the context from a perspective of his party, right? And Pedraga, is going to be interesting to see whether or not it could win votes in certain places and what sort of candidates it puts up there. It allows more people to come into the mix, but it also, it's still a highly personalized vehicle. And I think it could be a spoiler.
Right.
Unlike PAS, by the way. PAS and Johor, even though it won quite well in GE14, it won some support. I think with its current governance under the state election, under the Khedda chief minister, I think this is really alienating voters.
Hmm. Now, Bridget, a lot of, when we talk about disunity and all of these things, and we are on Twitter and we see what goes on. Twitter has been ablaze as of late. Opposition parties throwing bricks at one another and all of that. How much of this disunity is felt among the masses? How much do they particularly care? But especially when we're talking about Johorian voters. And what is this impact of this disunity towards the masses?
First of all, we all know that the Twitter space doesn't reflect ordinary voters, but it does provide headlines and shape the agenda. Right? But I also think to a certain degree, Twitter reflects a lot of the sentiments that are on the ground, particularly the sense of people, the anger among the electorate, the lashing out, the highly personalized natures of politics. And we do see quite considerable diversity of views. And this is what happens when there is weak leadership on the part of an agenda program. You see the public raising the issues. And in fact, I think that, we can see Twitter is being a very toxic environment, and we know that. And this week, I felt it myself. Unfortunately, I try to avoid those types of politics. But at the same juncture, it is also a space where new ideas are emerging, policy discussions are there because the issues are being raised. I think that it depends on how we see it in terms of these areas. Now, does it affect ordinary voters? No, but does it affect the political campaign and the relationship between different parties and the messages and the issues that are looked at? Yes. And I think the challenge is to take it into, make it into something more constructive. And it's very hard to do that in 160 characters where you can't edit. But at the same time, I think that I don't see it as all bad, but I do see that in terms of it's shaping especially the more rural and more older voters as pretty negligible.
Right. Now, Masli Male, who is the MP for Simpang Ronggam, the former education minister, as we know. His name has been mentioned a couple of times as a possible chief minister candidate of Johor. I'm wondering if this will be a sort of a huge pull factor, an inspiring factor for people to come out and vote, whether for PKR or for Harapan or for the opposition as a whole.
Well, I think, you know, first let's start why the CM candidate is actually an important contest. In Johor, I think that it is pretty clear that the UMNO campaign will be around the CM candidate, former CM Hasni Mohamed.
Right.
And they're anchoring the discussion within that, his leadership. And so, of course, the opposition needs to position an alternative leader. You know, now Masli has joined PKR. He's quite popular in Johor. Among all the opposition leaders. I mean, he's one of the most popular. He's dynamic. The issues he speaks about in terms of education are very important for the electorate, especially, you know, the female electorate, but not only that, and young voters, right? But he comes into this contest with a lot of liabilities. So, number one, he, of course, has seen as his relationship in Bersatu and Mahathir. You know, ironically, he himself is a frog, right? He's moved from Bersatu to PKR, right? And what is a frog? Somebody who's a defector, right? But the question is that people do see the defection from the cause or defection in the process, right? He changes political loyalties. But of course, the party changed. And this is what makes this problem of analyzing who are defectors much more complex than people actually want to give it credit to. But he also has liabilities when he was education minister in certain policies, particularly involving non-Malays, involving issues of Jawi and so forth. Where do I see him is coming in? His seat is highly competitive. He will need to win first. And I think that it will be also challenging for him. But it is interesting because if he does provide an alternative, what we can see is the emergence of another younger leader within PKR. And this is the other thing to keep in mind. There are a lot of talented young people in PKR. They've just been overshadowed by Anwar. And I think that this is something that I think will be important to see whether or not Masli can become the CM. It's going to depend on the fortunes of all the other parties and how they do. And I think that in particular, the fortune of Bersatu, of whether or not it wins seats and how many seats it wins. And I still feel that it is a very challenging context from a perspective of turnout, patterns of support for Pakatan Harapan and Johor.
And how do you think, whether it's Harapan or the opposition bench as a whole, how do you think they will perform in the upcoming Johor state elections, especially when we look at patterns from Sarawak, Malacca, it hasn't looked favorable towards the opposition at all.
Well, it's not. And I think a lot of this is the product of what's happened to the opposition itself and their own behavior is very self-destructive. But I also think it's that the terrain has changed. People are concerned about security. They go back to the things that are more nostalgic in the past. I think that, you know, we're going to see a situation in Johor the advantage clearly lies with UMNO, as we saw in Malacca. But when we see differences and the key steps that the opposition make in terms of setting up their program and others will be crucial in determining its future. Simple things like how DAP manages infighting, for example, can affect its performance in the seats. And it's not just about Harapan and the opposition, it's about how other parties emerge and evolve in that context. What I find interesting and very important about Johor has Johorians have a very important recognition of place and in their place in Malaysian history. Mm-hmm. And I think as the campaign will evolve, I expect there will be some very serious conversations and reflections taking place in Johor. And these are, I have a lot of faith in Johorians in terms of making the sets of the decisions that they do, even because they, you know, they're very practical and they're in this context. And the opposition needs to provide for them the option for them to choose them. And I think that whether or not they have to step up their game to deserve the votes that they might get. Right now, UMNO has stepped up their game, and I think that gives them the advantage.
Right. Before we wrap this conversation up, Bridget, a couple of times throughout this conversation, we discussed how, you know, whether there's too many parties competing and saturation and all of that. And fundamentally, what you said was, you know, it's saturation is good because it gives people a choice. So, choices are good, but it doesn't necessarily work properly in our current first-past-the-post electoral system. Do you think it's high time, especially with this intense sort of seat negotiation we are seeing, not just on the opposition side, but from the government side as well? Because, you know, who is the government these days? You know, in certain places like PAS and UMNO are friends, and then they're enemies, and you have Bersatu there, who's also friends and frenemies with them, and things like that. There's intense seat negotiations going on there as well. Yes. Do you think it's high time we switch to a proportionate sort of electoral system, something like a party list system or a ranked choice voting sort of thing?
So first point is that I think you're quite right to point to the fact that the government doesn't necessarily know which party that they're representing. And often they make, in the last week, we've seen lots of differences of opinion among themselves openly in public, which is really not indicating a weakness of the current prime minister. But I think in terms of a proportional voting system, one of its strengths is that it is a more inclusive system. And it's not just about ethnic communities. It's also about women. It's also about diverse political perspectives in terms of ideologies and others. Keep in mind that there are really important ideological differences going on in Malaysia, but this is not where the conversation is. Conversation tends to be on the personalized, except with the exception of issues of religion, which, of course, can be very divisive. But proportional voting system is one of the many reforms needed. I think it has to come with other things. In particular, I'm increasingly concerned about the Election Commission as an independent body and the need for greater transparency in the reforms on the part of the EC. And the more immediate thing that is necessary is for them to return back to more professionalism in that context. And I'm hoping that we will see that, although I am sanguine enough to know that we may not.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Bridget.
Most welcome. Lovely to chat with you.
That was Dr. Bridget Welch, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcast from. You just have to search Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.